I got up early this morning to check the news, and first up was just what I needed. At 7:25 this morning, Eastern Time, in that annually famous place of Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, a town dignitary hauled Phil out of his groundhog manufactured den and talked to the groundhog. The groundhog informed him that he had not seen his shadow. It was snowing. And that therefore there would be a shorter time before winter was over. And all the people who had started gathering at 3 a.m. to stand in the cold and the snow to see Punxsutawney Phil returned home, presumably happy. Here in Durango, I'm sorry to say, the rodents, you don't have any groundhogs here, there's some rodent or other who could be counted on to come out of a den at this time of year, and had they done that, they would have awakened like we all did to a gorgeously sunny morning and a forecast of 50 degrees, 6 more weeks of winter, starting tomorrow. Basically, the whole thing is so absurd that it's startling that Groundhog's Day gets even the human interest slot on the evening news. But you heard, perhaps from what Tom told the kids, that Groundhog Day is actually one of the oldest holidays that we Westerners still celebrate. Because foretelling the weather from the state of the cloud cover in early February is a practice nearly as old as Western humanity. Groundhog Day is actually a secularized version of an old pre-Christian holiday called Imbolc. In pre-Christian Celtic Europe, the people stayed very in tune with nature, and they celebrated the quarter days of the year, the solstices and the equinoxes, and the cross-quarter days, which are the days exactly halfway in between. Imbolc is celebrated at the halfway point between the winter solstice and the spring equinox. Here we are. The chief goddess of Imbolc was the goddess Brigid. In preparation for this holiday, the women finished the winter chore of making candles out of the fat that had been rendered at the fall slaughter and would soon turn bad. And some of the candles were lit in windows or doorsteps to guide Brigid into the homes of her followers. Does this sound a little bit like the luminarias that are put out in Hispanic neighborhoods to light the Holy Family's way on Christmas Eve? To make their homes inviting for Brigid, the old Celts took down the greens, which had hung since midwinter. Hope you've all done that by now. Cleaned up and asked for the goddess's blessing on their flocks, which had just begun to lamb, and their fields still fallow and winter covered. Brigid was a goddess of fertility, and the weather on Brigid Day was supposed to foretell the winter for the rest of the late winter season. Brigid was a mighty goddess. Her shrine was in Ireland and consisted of a community of priestesses who attended an eternal flame in her honor. These priestesses disseminated the knowledge of Brigid through the women of the land, the knowledge of healing herbs, curing springs, of smithcraft, and of writing. She was much too powerful to bow down before the Christian gods who were newcomers into the land, so the wise Christians called her Saint Brigid for a while, and for a while nuns tended her eternal flame. The Christians kept her feast day and celebrated the story of Mary's bringing the baby Jesus to the temple and hearing that he would grow up to be a light to the Gentiles, which seemed to fit in nicely with the old themes of flames and newborn lambs. And at this time of the year, the women brought the year's supply of newly made candles to be blessed by the priest. From that practice comes the Christian name of the holiday, Candlemas. But the Christians in most places were intolerant and impatient with any sacredness that was not their own. And in the year 1200, the Bishop of Ireland ordered the flame of the goddess Brigid, which had burned for time out of mind, to be doused forever. Now even Saint Brigid is gone from our hearts, all but our Irish Catholic hearts anyway, and all we have is Punxsutawney Phil. Or probably. probably the poorer for that. For a generation now, there's been a pagan revival of these old Celtic nature-oriented holidays. There was an in-bulk celebration at First Unitarian in Albuquerque last night. There was probably one here as a part of your ever-so-coincidentally-placed snow holiday last weekend. I think these modern pagans are actually onto something. There is something special, pregnant even, about this halfway point between winter and spring. Surely you've noticed, and probably gladly, that the coldest and darkest days of winter are over, that you wake at dawn now instead of in the dark, and maybe sup at dusk rather than at night. The sun can heat the interior of a parked car again, and that is something to celebrate. It's beginning to warm the ground. The bulbs are showing their first green shoots in protected places, and the most precocious of the trees, the maples and the willows, are starting to show the thickening that will soon be blossoms and leaves. It is no longer the deepest dark of winter. Of all the halfway points between solstice and equinoxes, the only other one you have ever thought about comes at Halloween, this is surely the most welcome. And you know, if we town dwellers with our forced air heat and electric lights notice and welcome this half-holiday of Groundhog's Day, then our ancient brothers and sisters must have truly celebrated. Thus it is that Groundhog's Day, bastard child of the great goddess, becomes an opportunity for modern liberal religious people to add to our calendar of the spirit our own yearly round of holidays, old and new, which might speak to our souls and suggest themes and work for our inner lives. Once the year was full of days like this, in Christianity there was a yearly round of things that you were supposed to contemplate, actions you were supposed to take, moods you were supposed to nurture, and all for your spiritual or religious growth. You fasted on Fridays, took a retreat during the week during Easter, celebrated saints' days and church seasons. In pre-Christian times, the spiritual calendar was tied directly to the seasons and the skies, the pagan wheel of the year, which some people are attempting now to reclaim as valuable to them. In this scheme, the winter is for soul work, the spring and summer for outward physical projects, the fall for endings and the contemplation of death, and for the preparing for that inner work of winter. We modern, secular people gave up all that other imposed stuff in order to be free to do our own thing. But many of us, after exploring the limits of that freedom, are casting about for some direction to our spiritual lives. And here we are at this old holiday, which somehow has refused to completely die. A day to remind ourselves that we live in nature and we can take its many clues for how to live a completely human, more connected life. And so at this time of the year, when we are more than unusually aware of the turning of the year, when the outdoor possibilities of gardens and vacations are still in the planning process, let's talk a little bit about how nature nurtures our spirituality. It's common knowledge that it does. Many of us feel spiritual in nature, though we may not be able to get a precise handle on our feelings. We just know that we're drawn to our gardens, our campgrounds, our mountains, and that something we gain there we don't get anywhere else, and that we returned refreshed in an important way. Is that what nature gives you? Nature, whether oceans or deserts, mountains or rose bushes, ski slopes, bird feeders, or trout streams, offer us several avenues to the spirit. These avenues don't exhaust the spiritual life, and they don't speak to everyone, but they're very widely used, and they're especially widely used by those of us who do not naturally experience the divine in prayer or scripture or speaking in tongues or in all the other ways that other human beings have found. Appreciation of the natural world as a spiritual discipline is in the Christian world as old as St. Francis and as new as the newest of the creation-centered spiritualities. And of course, the pagans, by definition, have worshipped in nature for eons. Where do the rocks and the waters and the vistas and the critters intersect with our spiritual life? Just what is it about being in nature that nurtures us, There are, I think, three themes. First and most commonly expressed is that the experience of the unity of nature is the experience of unity in nature. Secondly is the experience of awe and mystery, which comes when we encounter nature's forces, size, and intricacy. And thirdly is the experience of ecstasy, when we take risks, experience mastery of our environment, and confront the essentials of life. All these feelings are experienced as spiritual by many people, and they open our souls to a reality that's easy to miss in day-to-day living. The first of nature's gifts to the soul is the common experience of oneness. When we sit by a stream or gaze on the clouds on a colored horizon or look out through the trees during a mountain hike, one thing that we might experience, especially if we're expecting it or hoping for it, is a sense of oneness with all of the universe. Even the whiff of a neighbor's flowers on a twilight walk can bring that wonderful feeling that says, I belong here. It is, of course, possible to experience oneness in meditation and physical exercise, in conversation, in music. But for many people, the natural world provides the most reliable avenue to this important aspect of spirituality. Oneness with the water, the rock, the earth, and her creatures, deep knowledge of belonging. The spiritual high comes to many in nature and no other way. If you're one of those folks, regular excursions to gardens and mountains and riversides, fields and oceans and bird feeders must be a part of the way you care for your soul. Religion always is a matter of looking at the wholeness of things and the relationship between things. An appreciation of nature from the grand horizons of the desert to the intricate detail of a flower puts us in touch with the backside of that philosophy of estrangement that is a part of the day-to-day part of our lives. We are part of nature. We are children of the universe. We belong here, not over, but in the world. The sense of oneness that comes to a walker on a riverbank or an appreciator of the morning garden is a necessary corrective to a culture which wants to keep us in an unreal and separate world. Secondly, being outside has the tendency to remind us that we are small and our lives are surrounded in things that we do not understand. For all of the grandeur of our soaring thoughts and our clever hands, there's also the fundamental truth of life, though not one we're likely to dwell on in our workaday lives. Our factories and hospitals and shopping malls operate on the opposite assumption, that we kind of know most of what we need to know to get along and are in control of the things that most matter. Big man on the campus earth. It's our experiences in nature that offer a healthy corrective to this hubris. There is nothing like being on a small boat in a big sea, or a frail tent in a big wind, or one person in a sleeping bag under the infinite stars, or even one person peering out on an immense landscape to put things in a more realistic perspective. We are children of the universe, no doubt, but it's an infinite universe and we have more siblings than we will ever fathom. We are one among many here. Finally, nature offers us opportunities to take risks, experience mastery, and confront the essentials of life. Thoreau said this best when he left town to live at Walden Pond. I went into the woods, he wrote, because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what it had to teach. I wanted to live deep and suck all the marrow out of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put rout to all that was not life. And is that not the beauty of excursions in nature? From a backyard picnic to a wilderness backpack, you have to pare down just a little bit to take only what's necessary, to enjoy, really enjoy, tepid water and real sweat and sometimes even real danger. Mountain climbers, I hear, rate the difficulty of climbs in their DP, or death potential. They claim a spiritual high from their activities. This is not the sort of spirituality I am inclined to seek out, But it does seem analogous to the words of the English clergyman Samuel Johnson, who wrote about a friend who had been caught in forgery. When a man knows he's about to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully. So whether or not inviting Bridget into your life at this turning of the year appeals to you, you would almost certainly benefit by finding ways to incorporate nature in your everyday life. And it is so beautiful and easy to do here where you live. Our faith tends to be one which values the everyday experience of faith in life, wonder in life, love and hope in life. And where you will find many of those things is outside. This is why we love the earth, honor our human bodies, bless the stars. Religion is not just a matter of things unseen. For us, the holy is not hidden, but shows its face in the blush of the world's exuberance.
Do you have any additional comments you want to start with? Anything you want to
But I'd love to hear from you all about what you take from it and what it sparked in you.
Thank you.
I was very interested in the background of St. Bridget because it's a much different history that I studied being raised Catholic.
And they left out the first part of it, I suppose.
I was taught that, she wanted to become Catholic, and her pagan dad didn't want her to, so he cut her head off.
Oh, dear. Okay, well, that would be a different one from the goddess, Bridget. the earth mother who doesn't have a father. Oh, that's too bad. I didn't know that. But that was a part of, the Catholics in this part of the country, the Catholics were better in moving in and not taking away so much. But in the eastern part of the country, in most places in the world, the Catholics just moved in and brutally discredited, with stories like that, mm-hmm. The old ways and the old deities. They had learned some of their lessons by the time they moved into the southwest of the United States, it seems.
Do you see more integration of Catholic traditions with Native American traditions in
what they period? What they did from the beginning was allow both to coexist. So you have Native Americans who dance and dances and participate and sings and go to Mass on Sundays. And as a matter of fact, in the Pueblo areas down near Albuquerque, a feast day will start with a Mass, and then they go into the kiva and get ready for their dances, and the priest is there blessing the whole thing, and they just seem able, in this case, to ignore the fact that two religions are going on at the same time, there's no reason they shouldn't, to my mind, but mostly to the Catholic mind, it's not been possible, right? So, but there's been less... The Native American religions have stayed the way they were much more in the Southwest than virtually any other folks have been respected in the world.
It's interesting. We were talking at dinner last night about Tim and Carolyn just came back from Peru, and they were in the ruins there, Machu Picchu, and they were talking about a little bit of a tour. They were talking about how when the Incas were invaded by the Spanish basically destroyed all of their sacred religious sites. But
they never found Machu Picchu. Yeah, that was kept secret from them, and that's why
we know
anything about the Inca religion.
But that sounds very different than the Southwest
what happened
U.S.
Here. Yep, it is very different.
Spanish. Yeah. But, and that was about the same time, too. It was just, maybe it's 100 years earlier. I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't know. Not sure.
I was interested in your reflections on Catholicism's celebration of
day. I mean, mm-hmm. the celebration days. There were so much of
the year, the way the year goes
exactly,
around,
and the calendar, the way the calendar works, and we're just kind of reflecting on what we try to bring that in some respects, but it's not a big deal. Mm-hmm. It's not unified necessarily across our faith even,
right.
Which is very different. But I agree with you that I think we've lost something as mm-hmm. a result of that.
It's interesting. Protestantism, as I was growing up and even when I was in seminary, Protestantism tended to not have any seasons. There was a scheme with the different colors on the altar and things mm-hmm. like that, but nothing was made of it. Mm-hmm. There was a season of Advent, but it wasn't really talked about. But starting in the 80s, it seemed like the Protestants started to reclaim some of the richness mm-hmm. of the stuff they had originally rejected because mm-hmm. that was too Catholic, mm-hmm. Advent candles and things like that. And I had many Methodist and Presbyterian friends who tried to, you know, who kind of weathered the, we're doing Advent candles this year in their Methodist and Presbyterian churches and had to fight about it a little bit. let people get used to it and help them understand that it's not specifically Catholic and mm-hmm. it's good for you and stuff like that. So we're not the only ones to.
Sure. I mean, sort of a tangential thought on this of just evolution of religion and negating what's come before without mm-hmm. pulling some of it for. I don't know, maybe 10 years or so ago now, I found this book and read about the alphabet versus the goddess.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's just that same kind of concept in throwing out that iconography mm-hmm. that we did away as Protestantism came along and kind of religion became the word mm-hmm. and not, and we did away with iconography. So we did away with that aspect of knowing and learning and moved right. to this very, what we simplify as the left-sided brain mm-hmm. of just mm-hmm. words mm-hmm. kind of thing and what we lost mm-hmm. in doing that. Yeah. I don't know. It is
interesting, since that book was written, it's become abundantly clear that we're moving in, the whole society is moving in the other direction. Even books now are graphic. We have the ability to reproduce graphics in ways that we didn't have 50 years ago with the computers, and lots of people are getting, I go to YouTube whenever I need to know how to do something these days. I don't bother with written instructions anymore. So our brains are being better used now than they were in those days, and we'll see if that what effect that has, whether that will soften us as people in beneficial ways.
She was first. You're next.
So we have a landscape business, and that is my work, and we do not work in the field in the winter, and my husband and I talk a lot about how this way of living, and we're still parenting three children, it's not like we're sleeping through the winter, but mm-hmm. that this way of living, you know, is very agrarian, if mm-hmm. you will, even though we're landscaping million-dollar homes, but... I guess I'm trying to, you should have gone first. I guess my thoughts weren't finished. But I guess what I think about is that it's so natural to be active and working and physical and out in nature and experiencing the change of the seasons. I mean, interfacing with that on mm-hmm. a daily basis in the most beautiful and extravagant and also the most trivial and mundane ways to just, you know, see the simplest things and be, you know, awed by the beauty and wonder of it all, which is so outside of our control. So there's mm-hmm. even that spiritual sense there of how much is outside of our control. And then to rest in the winter. And I think something we talk about, my husband and I, is how is it affecting human health, even the health of the world, that we've come so far from being, you know, living in harmony and sort of mimicking nature in the way we're mm-hmm. living and just in the way we're existing, you know, that it's this 24/7 world that everyone is living in. all the time, that there is no season of rest. I guess that's really all I was getting.
You know, I mean, with the season of rest tended to come the season of being underfed also,
and cold.
Ill-nourished and cold and some of those kinds of things. So it's we can't romanticize it too much. But and, of course, out here, as opposed to the streets of New York City or Chicago, it's easy to live a town-like life and still be outside and still see, still appreciate the outdoors. Even in Chicago, you can do it if you want to.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I had similar thoughts to you, actually, but and you worded it very eloquently, so thank you. I think I feel also very frustrated in terms of just how we have adapted to more of a linear time scale than a cyclical time scale that came with these more earth-based traditions and celebrations. And so for me, like, when I was listening to your sermon, something that really inspired me was just thinking about that there are a lot of people like me who are moving more back into celebrating those traditions. For the past 3 years, I've been celebrating in bulk, and it has totally felt like just a reclaiming of my wholeness and the wholeness that I believe is possible for the world. And so just, I think for me, the wintertime has become a deeply meditative period of introspection in which I really honor my body, but also honor the seeds that I'm going to be planting for the coming year in terms of my goals and my hopes and my dreams. And I think that really being able to like go deep into that last winter like really made it possible for me to be able to be in this space now and be in New Mexico this year. So I'm just, I'm really grateful for the wisdom and of the traditions that were in early Celtic times, because for me that's a part of my ancestry and it reminds me about who I am.
Okay, thank you.
You were talking about city rural. I mean, the figure that jumped into my mind was something, 70% of the world lives in urban areas. And so, I mean, that's got to be really hard to, you know, attach.
I got mine. and 70% of the world that lives in urban areas just lives in urban areas without Central Park, without the Chicago shoreline, without the mountain. We've seen some of the pictures that have come in from China, and you know, those folks are not getting nature at all, and there's an awful lot of them, and oh gosh.
I was a little bit surprised with your suggestion that maybe not all humans feel that sense of connection to nature. I just assume that it has to do being hardwired into our genetic code because of evolution. So that was a new thought to me, that there might be some individuals that don't have that experience.
I know one of those individuals. My former husband was raised in Manhattan, and his brother had never been out of a 20-block radius of their home. And when I first met him, it just like blew my mind that he hadn't been outside of that area, very insular life.
Well, but he still had a window. You know, a person could be in a very insular life. My mom, in her assisted living place, hardly ever getting out of the building, nonetheless had this relationship with the birds at her bird feeder outside the window that was precious and important to her. But she was the only gal in that place that did.
And in an environmental psychology class that I took one time, we talked about place bonding. Mm-hmm. And the importance of going to a place regularly and building a relationship with it. But they made the point that it could even be as simple as a house plant.
Right. And it's very common, but nothing is for everybody. And we have to remember that most of the world's people would say, what do you mean they don't have an interior relationship with God? How could you be human and not do that? So we got to be careful, because people say things about us like that. Mm-hmm. Then we say, how do you do that? No. As a matter of fact, I have never had, whatever. People are different. Some people do their best indoors, and that's okay. But I imagine that most people who live in Durango in part chose it because their own spirit is somehow fed by these spaces and this landscape. So tell me how. How are you all fed by your landscape?
So one thing that's very clear to me is that it has habituated me to being grateful. Mm. And it's not just me. I feel like I can be at any sort of event and somebody will look around and say, I'm so happy that we live here. So people, that upwelling of feeling at home and at peace and so fortunate to be in this spot. Mm-hmm. I think that it helps with that, which is spiritual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just raised my hand to say, wow, look at this. As a kid, I would cry. Mm-hmm. If I could get us, I have no idea why I'm doing this now. It surprises me.
Because it's important. It's an important
memory.
It
was very important to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I lived in Iowa, for God's sake, and we lived where it was a short walk down the end of my street to where we have this wonderful wild creek and woods, and there was woods over there. They never developed. I had it nearby, but just to be sick and look out the window was too much. Anyway, I live and breathe nature. I love it.
I had one of those childhoods that you could just wander.
Oh yes,
down the street. You reminded me of the woods. In the woods all the time, mm-hmm. all the time.
Yep. Exploring and figuring things out.
Yep.
For me, it's mountains and beaches. It's, mm-hmm. There's no effort at all. It just happens, that connection. So
there's something about this, the near infinite hugeness of it all. That's
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that a prairie would do that same thing, but it might at sunrise and sunset, because that would be spectacular.
I was sitting here and holding this arm of the chair, connecting with nature.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
This wonderful oak that this tree created. I can feel the pores in it. I can feel the grain that's there. All we have to do is open our eyes and our minds to realize that everything we have, everything we are, is from nature. Mm-hmm. It is, even the synthetic material here came from petroleum products that was created in nature. Mm-hmm. So it's everything. Mm-hmm. If we want to see that that's what it is.
And it's connected to us.
And I just want to point out that the petroleum didn't come from dinosaurs. So it's phytoplankton and zooplankton, right? Oh. Little critters, animals, and plants.
Our plastic is vegan.
In the ocean. So, yeah, I don't know. Connecting? Right, yeah. Photosynthesis. So anyway, don't get the dinosaur image from that Chevron ad. But no,
there
I was going
to
say
dinosaurs to make that much oil.
Yeah, I was just going to say that growing up in Houston in the Catholic Church, Houston, Texas is a flat coastal plain, And I used to get really excited when we would go on the freeway overpasses because I could see for a long distance. So I've always loved altitude and mountains, and I would get so excited when we would drive an hour north and start getting, you know, actual topography hills.
Some feet under you.
So, but it also taught me to appreciate lush vegetation and subtropical plants, and I'm still trying to grow them in Colorado in my living room from Houston. I really should drive them back. They're just not thriving. Huh?
Free the plants.
Free the plants.
I appreciate my own garden as well as the gardens all around, but I aspire to feel connected like Mary Oliver does in so much of her work. I'm trying to think. There's a poem that she's written that's talking about a caterpillar, and it's like her ability to totally be with one small piece of being or existence and to be patient to experience that piece of nature. It just inspires me on so many levels. One is to actually notice closely, but the other is to be able to make it so important to notice that I can put everything else aside to really experience this one small thing. That's what I'd like to be able to do.
I think it's really interesting that we talk about nature different from us, that there's nature and then there's us. It's not. I mean, we're just as much nature as a dinosaur or an ant or a plant. This is all who we are.
Yeah. But we don't look at ourselves.
But the mental set is separate.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we grew up that way.
Well, and that's the mental Western set.
Yeah,
it's it didn't exist in the time of Bridget, and it doesn't necessarily exist as sharply in the East. But we Westerners, we got this us and them thing with nature, we conquer nature, forgetting that if we conquer nature, we're in trouble ourselves, and that's why we're in trouble ourselves, right?
Yes.
Christine, thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
And I just walked in, and I'm going to jump right into what Tom said. A lot of people here probably know that I'm a wildlife activist, specifically wolves, and I have brought this topic up before about UU in general, and that is the fact that and this is my own personal perspective, obviously. We are focused on social justice, which is just fine and dandy and wonderful. But what I don't believe we are focused on as far as taking care of it is the natural world. And specifically us people here in Durango, Colorado, we live in a wildlife paradise. Just to give you an example, in 2017, 67 black bears were euthanized in one fashion or another here in this county, in La Plata County, because of interactions with people. And I'm not saying we have to do something world in a spectacular fashion or whatever. I would just like to have the awareness more of what you were talking about today, Christine, of how much we rely on the natural world for our well-being as human beings and how connected we are to that. And maybe I have I'm obviously a little biased because of my activism. Anyhow, I just thank you for bringing this topic up, and what Tom said is so important. We're not separate from the natural world, and the natural world is hurting right now, big time, because of all of the environmental issues and all the political issues. Just this week, and I'll stop right here, the state of Wyoming announced that they're going to kill 72 grizzly bears in the southern portion of the greater Yellowstone area into the Tetons because of predation on livestock. Now, there's a long history of antagonism from the livestock industry and endangered species. It's not something I want to push against, but it's something I would like the awareness to go up and be for supporting the natural world.
Okay.
there's maybe time for one last comment before we adjourn. Anyone want to jump in? One. Oh, two. Okay, we can do this fast.
Well, in connection with that, you know, because we live in this wonderful place, and some people are just don't seem to be aware of our impact as humans on the natural environment. And I guess some people know that I'm kind of a recyclable crazy, but I've been that way for a long time because of the impact of what we don't recycle and we throw out. It affects all of us and all the natural world. And, I mean, I'm constantly recycling in places. To me, it's amazing. This town, where we're supposedly so in touch with nature and we're so green, and it says people who don't recycle, in my opinion, are not very aware of the environment and of the greenness that we are supposedly espouse in this town. So that's kind of my gripe.
Thank you, and we invite you to join the environmental justice team. One last comment.
Oh, I just wanted to express gratitude for the river. I find that a lot of my soul-seeking and well-being has been received very humbly by my friend River, and will always be so. And then I think my second thought went towards the perceived separation between ourselves and the earth. And I think for me, how I tried to remember to be in union is through my breath, and that the breath that I have connects me to all living and non-living beings, and that pulse connects me to the earth. So that's something I suggest you try at some point.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you all for coming. Christine, thank you very much for being
here
this morning.
Pleasure. Thanks. You all. Oh, yes. Isn't that a good
one? Yeah.